And what Judy didn't mention is that our next in-person retreat will be in Maui. We'll be doing that in July in Maui. Yep. So... Judy, I said to Judy, it occurred to me in the middle of the night, this was my middle of the nightism last night, so, and I texted Judy first thing, and I said, don't contract with the Embassy Suites for March, I want to do this in Maui, in July. And I also said to Judy, I'm not really sure how many people are going to want to go, so raise your hand if you want to go. Okay, all right. Well, that's where it will be. Did somebody say, is this a joke? No, it is not a joke. No, it is not a joke. That's where we're going to do it. So, I don't know yet. Yes, 2 weeks. Good. Well, I encourage you all, no matter how long it is, even if it's this length, to take a lot of extra time there. A lot of extra time there. Long walks on the beach every day. July will be past whale season. Whale season is earlier than that, but I've been there every July for the last many years, and it's just gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. I've used the word frequency a couple of times this weekend, but I wondered what the planetary energy was in Maui. So I looked it up in a couple of different places, and every time I looked, it said that Maui was the heart of the planet. And I know Ram Dass lived there for many years, the last maybe 20 years of his life. He lived in Mill Valley for a while. And he said he loved Maui because it was as close energetically to India as any place he'd ever been. India was my first favorite place I've ever been. No wonder I love Maui. It's just beautiful. The air, the fragrance, the everything. It's warm in July. It's not too hot. Anyway, good. I'm glad. Judy was positive everybody was going to like that maybe a little bit better than the Embassy Suites in San Rafael. What do you think? Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. Matt and I were talking about it this morning. He said to me, I don't know. It's a long way for people to go. And it's like, yep, I know, but then it's Maui. You get off the plane and there you are, Maui. So, good. Okay. So, we always start by arriving where we are, by sort of bringing our attention particles back to this. First of all, if you haven't already looked around this room, just orienting yourself. So, and that helps to get out of your mind. Just want to like realize, okay, I'm not living in my mind right now. I'm actually sitting. This physical body vehicle is in a physical space. And here's what it is. So orienting, then grounding, feeling your feet on the floor. Just really arriving where you are. Arriving where you are. and sensing what's going on in your bodies. Is there flow? Is there a place that's particularly hot, warm, cold, cool, contracted, painful, open? Just notice without judgment and without preference. Without preference. Oh, this is what's happening in this body-mind. Yeah. And for you to notice what's happening in the body-mind, you can't be the body-mind. If you can see it, you're not it. If you can see it, you're not it. You are that which is aware of it. You are the awareness through which all realities, including this body-mind, arise. I think it can be a little cooler in here, Jay. A little. Couple degrees. And if you feel to, you can put your index finger and your middle finger at that center point in your heart. Letting your mind drop down into your heart, that analytical, know-nothing mind. That thinks it knows everything and knows nothing. The mind has no answers, the heart has no questions. The mind has no answers, the heart has no questions. Feeling that space of awareness, of awakeness, or of awaring, as the teacher Tony Packer called it. Noticing the breath, taking full belly breaths, and allowing yourself to rest, relax, allow, receive. Allowing the story and the bric-a-brac revolving hamster wheel of the mind, just noticing it, nothing to do about it, don't need to stop it. You can look between the thoughts, Or notice the flow of thoughts. No resistance to the thoughts. Okay, good. You can open your eyes. So, we've been speaking of alluding to and noticing that we see the world as our wounds are. Or another way of saying it is, we see the world as we are. That's another way of saying it. You don't have to put the wound word in there, although I would say of the billions of people in the world, 99.9999999% of the people are seeing through wounds, because undoing these wounds, unwinding them, seeing through them, takes noticing them, and being aware of them, and being willing to do the work of them, of this. It takes really being willing to be uncomfortable. Because, as I said yesterday, when they developed, the situations in which they developed as children, before we were four, most of them before we were talking, those situations felt unbearable. And what we concluded about ourselves, therefore, was just unbearable. So we didn't bear them, because a kid can, otherwise the very fragile and developing ego structure shatters, fragments. So all children push down those conclusions and develop a set of adaptive behaviors. How can I make my mommy and daddy happy together? What do I do when they're fighting? How can I help things when my daddy's drunk? When my mom is lonely? What do I need to be in order to fix the situation out there, so that I am not deeply uncomfortable in here? And that those adaptive behaviors, I talked about mine being bossy yesterday, hypervigilant, I would say kind of sort of obstructive, because nobody in my family wanted to notice what was going on, kept denying what was going on, no matter how many times I held up a metaphorical chalkboard and said, look, see, this is horrible. You're lying. You're cheating. You're hitting. You're never here. Everything was fine. Nobody wanted to see the elephant in the living room, so I became the elephant in the living room. I became what you just couldn't trip over. I became that no before I said yes. I don't like this. Which was a valence of the bossiness, but the a kind of demandingness. Even though I didn't demand my mother do anything, because I would get in trouble if I did, but there was a kind of porcupine-ness, I would say, to my personality. So what we want to look at, because I gave a lot of thought to what Nicole said yesterday about I've been to a lot of things and I thought they were going to do it, and so far this hasn't done it. The way that anything changes is by remembering and taking action on what needs to be remembered and letting go. Yesterday I said, don't pay attention to anything that you don't want to grow. So most of us are paying attention to what's wrong, and we have the constant feeling that it's growing. And what we often do is try to change the outside. I'll make this better. I'll make mommy and daddy happy. Or if I am, I no longer feel inclined to any political activism. I did, and it felt right when I did it. Now it doesn't. But if I would do it now, it would be an attempt, would be an inauthentic attempt, I might add, because it's not actually coming from me. It's coming from a should. It would be an attempt to change out there without changing in here. I want to say, and I know this is probably going to be hard to believe, the biggest, most powerful and radical thing you can do to change out there is to change in here. It's to change the energy, the attitude, the frequency that you put out there, because that affects everyone around you. The person on the phone who's kept you on hold forever, the grocery store clerks, the gas station, the people you meet at the gas station, your partner, your kids, your colleagues, everybody. When you change, the whole world changes. So that you get to the point of what Krishnamurti said, the spiritual teacher in the late 20th century, when somebody said to him, but how do you do what you do? He said, I don't mind what happens. I don't mind what happens. How do you not mind what happens? You, by not taking things personally. Why do you take things personally? Because you think there's a me person here, and you've got to get the outside to align with what you think should be happening. What would make you feel comfortable? So we keep on trying to change out there. Don't say that to me. Don't talk to me like that. I don't like it when you do that, as if they changed, this would change. But it never does. So we're reeling ourselves back in, reeling ourselves back in to the cause of it, rather than solving the problem with the external. Because I mean, you can just look at the at what many people are saying is what I said yesterday, a shit show, and what's happening out there politically, and the commentary on that. And so yes, it might be a little different than what happened 200 years ago, but pretty much it's the same. Everybody hates each other, except the people that are you're very close to, and people are at war with each other. Is it different? Is what some people say, this move to fascism or authoritarianism, is that different than what was going on? Maybe. But it's not going to change out there. It's not going to change out there. The only way to change is you first. You first. You see the events of the world the way you see yourself. That's how it goes. There is no other way. If those events change, you still see yourself that way, and you perceive everything else that way too. So we're going to work on now, how do you change how you see yourself so that the seeing changes, your experience of being alive, your experience of moment to moment. We're talking moment to moment. Life itself, how life lives itself through you, will determine how you experience being alive. And how you see life living itself through you is determined by how you see yourself. And, you know, I used the analogy yesterday of yellow glasses, or we could use the word, you know, if my glasses now were cracked and shattered, I'd be looking at you and you'd look cracked and shattered. There is no other way. I mean, if you actually think about it for a second, you get it. It's not going to come from out there. It isn't ever going to come from out there. And the sooner you allow that as the truth, the sooner you're willing to turn towards yourself and see what's creating the shattered lenses. Because that is the only thing that will do it. How do I know? How do you know? You and I have tried 9,000 bazillion trillion things. We've tried. For myself, I've sat at the feet of enlightened masters. I lived in India. I went on countless spiritual retreats. I did 40 years of therapy, many of which were with fabulous therapists. And the combination, if I put them together, 80 years, 40 years of therapy, 40 years of spiritual practice, it didn't do it until the last couple of years, when I was introduced to the technology, I can call it technology, process, practice, that we're going to work with today. We use two practices or technologies in our work. We use the eating guidelines. They're the main on the ground with food practice. They are true always. They were true in 1978 when I first wrote them. I had a big meeting with my publishing company the other day, and they were asking me about the eating guidelines. Have they changed? No. Is it better now to eat when you're not hungry? Is it better to not stop when you've had enough? I mean, there are certain universal laws. I could actually call the eating guidelines the universal laws of natural eating, because that's what they are. So we use those, and they're true in the beginning, the middle, and the end. They're always true. They're never, ever not true. The only thing that has shifted about those is that I used to say, eat what you want. Now I say, eat what your body wants. And further discriminate, because I've written a chapter to my new book called Eating My Words. And what I explain in that chapter is, unless there's an adult present, when you say, eat what your body wants, you're asking a 3-year-old. You're asking a 5-year-old. And you're not going to get a clear answer. So in many ways, the eating guidelines and the technology of the eating guidelines, I don't really like that word. I don't really know another word, but we call it the practices. And the practices of the 6 steps, which we're just about to do, go hand in hand with each other. Because unless there is internal and authentic voice saying to you, you know what? I don't really want to eat popcorn right now, even though it sounds good. It's not what this body, what taking sweet care of this beloved pet would do. But in order to know that, it takes at least some degree of clearing the wounds, of clearing the shatteredness through which you're looking. Because it's not that you look out there, you do, but it's that you look at yourself like that. And when you look at yourself through shattered lenses, internal shattered lenses, you look shattered. And most of us feel shattered. We don't talk about it. We don't say it like that. We don't present ourselves like that. We present ourselves in, you know, upstanding ways. But for the most part, we feel shattered. So let's talk about the six steps. The six steps were created by a man named, you'll all get this in your email. You don't need to take notes. Judy's going to email this to you after the session. So I would recommend that you just listen and take in as much as you can, because you'll have it all written down. You'll have it right there in your little email box. The six steps were created by a man named Diederik Walsack. And I was introduced to them 5 years ago by the teacher I've told you about, Coco, who also found them incredibly helpful. And so I've been working with the six steps now for 5 years, pretty much steadily, almost every day. And the practice has changed dramatically from when I started. The six steps haven't changed, but now I know the laser version of them. So I don't need to go through every single one of them every single time. But I did for quite a while. And sometimes I still do if I'm really triggered. I still do. So the first step is that, and I will take you through this in a visualization in a few minutes. So I'm just going to give you the outline of it, so then you know what it is, and then we can do it together, and then we can talk about what it felt like, that you're triggered. And so the first step is I'm triggered. And I'm triggered means I'm charged about something, I'm irritated about something, I'm upset, angry, sad, lonely, I feel rejected, I feel abandoned, I'm agitated. And often we think that anybody would be, if they were like my friend in the radiation, I'm sorry I keep using this, but it's the clearest one, anybody would feel like she was brutal and it was horrible for your best friend to ghost you on the day you got back from radiation from breast cancer. Anybody would feel that. Maybe anybody would, well, Krishnamurti wouldn't. He would say, I don't mind what happens. And most or many teachers would say the same thing, but not me. I was quite triggered. But that's a radical example. It could just be something somebody said to you this morning. A sort of nonchalant remark that you were like, eh, I didn't feel so good. I didn't like that. So there's that. I'm triggered. That's the first one. From the littlest, teeniest, teeniest, teeniest trigger, you know, I wrote about in Love Finally, my mother giving me things and then asking for them back. And, you know, the latest one that I wrote about, the last time she did that, I wrote about quite a few times in that particular chapter, was when she asked me for a necklace she had given to me back. And instead of realizing I was triggered, and working with it myself, this was years before I discovered the six steps, I said to her, your neck is too fat. You can't ever wear that necklace. No. So that didn't deal with it. Your neck is too fat, Mom. And what I write in Love Finally was, I knew I shouldn't have said that, but I was gleeful that I did. I was so happy that I finally talked back to her. And because I did send her everything she asked for back over many years. And this time, I just didn't. No, you can't because you're fat. And that felt deeply satisfying since she had been telling me I was fat since I had been 11 years old. So I'm triggered. But the truth was, I was triggered. All I had to do, when you shoot something back to somebody and respond with no or whatever, that's the sign. You're triggered. Often we don't pick it up because we think anybody would feel like this. We just feel like, who the hell are you just giving me things? In fact, I sent my book to a friend, and everybody who reads, there's been five people now who've read the book, writes me back and says, don't ever give your mother anything back when she asks you for something back, or tell your mother this, or, but, you know, I want to say, but are you doing the six steps? Are you actually, have you learned anything from the book itself? Everybody's so mad at my mother when they read this that they don't quite get the whole point of me recounting these stories is to go deeper in them. So I'm triggered. The second step is it's about me. And this is really falling on a sword. I got to say, this is the sword. There are two swords here in the six steps. The first is it's about me, meaning it's not about my mother. It's not about that she asked me for a necklace she had given me back. It's about me and what comes up in me. That's what this is about. It's about me. And this is so hard to get. And it's still hard for me to get, no matter how many times I've done this. If I really feel triggered, I feel like, no, this is the exception. This really is not about me. This is about her. Or this is about Matt. I can't believe he did that. Of course I'm angry with him. So that doesn't mean there's nothing to work out after this. It means that the feelings, so I'm triggered, it's about me. What do I feel? What do I feel? When my mother asks for something back that she's given me, I feel like I've been erased. I just feel like I don't matter. I feel like I feel unloved. I don't matter and I feel unloved. Then the fourth step is, what's the first time you felt like this? What's an early time? It doesn't necessarily have to be the first time, but what's an early time you felt like this? And in me, I'm going to use myself as an example here. I remember, this isn't exactly it, but there's the famous, there's a whole chapter in the book called The Eskimo Coat, because my mother gave me what looked like an Eskimo coat, even though you're not supposed to say Eskimo anymore. It's not politically correct. It's Inuit. The Inuit tribe, but it's a little clunky in my mouth to say the Inuit tribe coat. So I just call it the Eskimo coat because that's what I learned when I was that old. She gave me this coat that we saw in the Princeton ski shop, and she wore it for a little while, and I craved it, and I wanted it, and she promised it to me for my birthday. And then a week before my birthday, when I was counting the days till I got the Eskimo coat, my cousin Laura came to visit. My cousin Laura, some of you have heard about. She was my mother's sister's daughter. She was dropped off at an orphanage when she was two by my Aunt June, her mother, who dropped her off on her way to New Orleans to become a stripper. And she called my mother when she was out of town and said, Laura's at the orphanage, go pick her up. And so my mother did go pick her up, and a big thing, there was a custody battle and all that, but Laura spent a lot of time living with us, and I hated her guts because my mother treated her really well. Never yelled at her, never hit her, never did anything. My mother was an angel mother. And the week before my birthday, I was standing in the kitchen. I heard Laura and my mother in the next room, no doors. Laura saying, I like your coat. My mother said, you can have it. And I was standing there listening to this. Been 6 months of waiting for my birthday. And she gave it away. And I said something like, and I never talked back at my mother because that did not end up well. But I did talk back, and she said, you're so selfish. Go to your room now. And I did. So I can go back to that. That's one of like 50 incidents like that with my mom of giving and taking. And I can go back, and I can go back to that exact situation. I can see myself, the wallpaper, Laura and my mother. I've changed Laura's name in the book to Lola. She asked me to change her name. I did. I'm sure she's not going to like the part where I've written, I hated Lola and I wanted her to die. That's what I wrote in my book. I hated her and I wanted her to die. But I did. It's true. I wanted her to die. I just never wanted to see her again. It was awful. So how did I feel about, so I go back to that standing in the kitchen listening to my mother and Laura about the Eskimo coat, and I just feel again like I don't matter, totally like my existence has been wiped off the face of the earth. My mother doesn't seem to remember that it's been 6 months of promising this to me, and then she's mad at me for being upset about it. Go to your room. What was my conclusion? That's the fourth step. First step, triggered. Second step, it's about me. Third step, feeling. Fourth step, the early situation. Fifth step is conclusion that you've made about yourself. My conclusion was, I'm selfish. I'm mean. I don't matter. My existence doesn't matter. There was actually a basket of conclusions there, not just one. But one that stayed with me forever was, I'm selfish. I can't believe I didn't think about Laura. I didn't really know for a long time what happened to Laura, but I knew that both my father, who put her through school and, you know, just basically supported her, and my mother felt, when I cried to my father, he'd say, bad things happen to Laura, we need to be very nice to her. My response was, I don't want to be nice to Laura. I hate Laura. I want her to die. So I'm sure my parents were not thrilled with their altruistic daughter. But anyway, and those were my conclusions. I'm just mean. I'm just selfish. And my existence doesn't matter. The last step, the sixth step, is about awareness / forgiveness. It's about shining light on what was heretofore unbearable to shine light on. That conclusion and the pain that went along with it are all wrapped up together. They're wrapped up together. The selfish, I'm mean, and my existence doesn't matter. Once I name that, I can see that of course it wasn't true. And this is the other place of falling on a sword, because many people believe their conclusions. But it was true. But I was mean. But I was selfish. But if I was a kind of person, I would have been happy to give the Eskimo coat to Laura. Laura, of course, doesn't remember this at all. I've talked to her about it. We had a lot to work through, Laura and I, as we got older, because she also was always on my mother's side and lied to me constantly about what my mother was doing, which made me insane. Because as I got older, I saw what my mother was doing in terms of her having affairs and, you know, going out, and Laura knew and told me that I was seeing things, as did my mother. So Laura and I, we had a lot, a karma between us. We're good now, but good because I forgave myself for believing that what I concluded about myself was true. You can't move until you get that. Until you get that you are, I'm going to put words in this, but that's not the direct experience. You are light itself. You are true nature. You are not your body, you're not your mind, you're not what happened to you, as Gabor Mate said. You're your interpretations of what happened to you, and it's those exact interpretations that we're dealing with right now. We're dealing with those in this. The other thing that people often use, that Lorraine used to use, Ho'oponopono, whatever, I can't remember the rest of that, I'm sorry, thank you, please forgive me, I love you. You know, that goes some of the way here. That's a Hawaiian practice. But it doesn't go all the way because it doesn't unearth and shine the light of awareness on what you believe is true. And that's what we want to do. And it takes doing this. I've done this, so I've been doing it for 5 years now. And I'd say the first 3 or 4 years, I did it, I don't know, sometimes multiple times a day. Every time I got triggered. Because what else was there to do except blame somebody else? This cuts through. There are no victims with the 6 steps, and there's no blame. No victims, no blame. That's the gorgeousness about that. If I'm feeling something about my friend Christine ending our relationship, it's what I'm feeling. It's not because she did that. I mean, that's a longer story about the lies I told myself about my relationship with her. That's one of the first things Coco asked me when I first started seeing her and I told her about Christine. And she said to me, what's the first lie you told yourself about Christine? And I shot back immediately and I said, Jesus, I can't believe you're putting this on me. Gee, she said, this is about you. This is not about her. Not for a second did she ever, ever say one negative thing about Christine, ever. And it drove me crazy. And she still hasn't ever said a negative thing about anybody. So this is an ongoing daily practice. And in order to unwind the wound, you have to unwind she who perceives she was wounded. Well, we've all been wounded, and that it's somebody else to blame. Judy, could you start taking pictures now of things? My publishing company would like them. I'd like you to take a lot of pictures. Nobody's faces, please. Yeah. Time to take pictures. I have to get with the program, according to them. You know, I've been off the program of Instagram and Facebook and social media, and they were like, guess what, Janine? Time to get back on. Any questions before we move along? Yes.
I think think I missed the part where you mentioned a teacher, and I'm not understanding.
You know what? It's not important. Let's just go into the visualization, because I'm just looking at the time. We've got 40 minutes. I want you to do the practice. Anything you hear with your mind and think you understand is okay, but it's not going to help you with this. The direct experience is the teacher isn't important. She's who introduced me to the six steps. That's all you need to know. Okay, so you ready to do the visualization? And then we are going to divide into groups of three. Okay, I'm going to pour myself some water. My throat's a little dry. I want to say, if I haven't made it clear, this is not something you understand with your mind. It's not something you understand. You directly experience it. You can hear about it, but until you directly experience it and practice it multiple times and feel the opening, the release, the pop of, oh, it's like the veils get lifted, the shattered glass comes off. That's what happens, and you are who you've always been. So that's what this is about. It's about awake awareness. It's about the kind of blooming we talked about yesterday, where you bloom, but nobody else can do this for you. It's your own sincerity and earnestness. That's all that it is. If you don't do it, it doesn't happen. If you don't practice it, if you don't take this on as a practice. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of other practices. This is the one that worked and continues to work for me, in which, at least in my own experience, freedom has happened over and over and over and over again. Freer and freer and freer and freer and freer. Okay. I'm going to take some. Take some long, deep breaths in. And let them out. Allow yourself to relax. I'd like you to, as if you were turning back through the pages of a book with your eyes closed, go back to a time. It could be this morning. It could be before the session started. It could be once the session did start. It could be yesterday, could be last week. Doesn't have to have happened here, but it could. Could be something I said. Could be some trigger from something I said where you felt judgmental and aggravated and irritated and just, you know, like Lucy in the Peanut comics when she goes, bleh. You know, it's that feeling of, you know, being pressed upon and not liking it and wanting to shake it off and get rid of it. Going back to that and really, really honing in on that. See exactly what happened. See exactly what happened. In your mind, at least, create a space where you get to sit down and really be with yourself. What happened? Who was there? Who said what? And notice that you were triggered. That's all you need to notice now. There's a charge there. Could be teeny, an irritation. You could have felt rejected or abandoned. It could be bigger than a little irritation. So you're triggered. And then the next step, step two, is it's about me. It's about me. So taking those attention particles from the person or situation that triggered you and bringing them back. It's about me. Then the third step, notice what you felt. What did you feel? Did you feel irritated? Did you feel hurt? Rejected? Did you feel abandoned? Lonely? Outraged? What did you feel? And then ask yourself, when was an early time you felt this same way? When was an early time you felt this same way? And zero in on that situation. For you, who was there? How old were you? Look around. Who said what? Who did what? Who were the actors in this situation? So the feelings were similar. This was one of the first times you felt the way you felt in this recent situation when you were triggered. And what did you conclude about yourself based on what happened in this early situation? What did you decide about yourself? What kind of child deserves to be treated like this? Notice what you believed about yourself because this happened. What was the conclusion zero in on that. It could be, I'm damaged. I'm alone. I don't matter. I just can't do it right. And then, with this, knowing this conclusion and allowing it, allowing it, allowing it, it could be very painful. Just allowing it, it will come to pass. And then with the light of awareness and presence, shining light like sunlight on mold, on something that's never been true, understanding that this conclusion could not be true. It was a lie, an interpretation that was unavoidable because every child thinks it's about them. Every child. So this is unavoidable. Seeing that child and with a full heart saying, I forgive you for ever believing, that you didn't matter or you weren't enough. Or that you were mean or damaged or wrong. I forgive you. It could never be true. The awareness and the forgiveness are synonymous with each other. To see that it was never true is also forgiving the act of it. Understanding that there wasn't any other way this could have happened except you deciding this about yourself, which you have been carrying with you as a wounded conclusion for your entire life. I forgive you for ever believing that you didn't matter, that you weren't life itself. Light itself. I forgive you. This could never have been true. This is not true. In this moment, you become the one you've been waiting for. Presence itself. Love itself. holding yourself close to your heart. Seeing the beauty of you. I forgive you for believing this lie. I forgive you. It was a lie. It was never, ever true. And then slowly, ever, ever, ever so slowly, bringing yourself back to the present moment. Until you have a sense of being back here in this moment. If you need a tissue, please raise your hand. Take a moment just of being with yourself. And then, please pick a partner. We're going to do a dyad. A partner, please. Kim, what about you? Judy, could you make sure Kim has a partner and we're going to go on because I'm going to tell them what to do. I'm going to let you take care of this. Okay? So, between you and your partner, everybody needs to have a partner and be part of this exercise. Decide who's going to go first, and then tell your partner what happened, what your experience was, speaking from your heart. And so each of you has 3 minutes to speak. So, Joyce, did your question get answered, by the way? Did this process, do you still have that question? Okay. You didn't miss anything important, Joyce. Yes, good. Okay, so who would like to ask a question, find out anything about... Yes, Arazu.
I struggled at the end with the forgiveness. And I'm sure it's because the mind is trying to understand it. I don't blame myself for what I believed. So how can I forgive myself? If that makes sense.
So do you still believe it?
Yes. When I get triggered. Okay. I believe it, but I don't think I'm at fault for believing it.
It's not about fault.
Okay.
It's about the fact that you have a conclusion that's not true. You're forgiving the lack of truth of it. And if the word forgiveness is too loaded, and it is for so many people, throw it out the window. Forget it. Just see that it wasn't true. And see what happens. It's not the forgiveness that's important. It's really getting it that what you have believed about yourself for your entire life is a lie.
Got it. Thank you. That helps a lot.
Yes. Good. Good question, Arazu. Thank you. Yeah, Gina. Do you need a mic, Gina?
I realized from a long time that the victims, or when I felt like that...
You have to talk louder, because even I can't hear you.
Okay, perfect. That for a long time I was waiting for my father to say... If he said to me, "I'm really sorry," I will be free. For a long time, I was just hoping that.
So what did you see here?
I see it now, and I see it before that. I stopped waiting. I don't want him to telling me that he's sorry, to have a space in life. So I deserve my space in life, but it took me years because I was waiting him to let me be in life.
Okay. Thanks, Gina. So I will say again that it doesn't matter if somebody apologizes. It doesn't matter. That's not going to ever heal the wound. It's not going to heal the wound because the wound is yours. It's yours. It got installed here. It's not going to get better. It's like throwing ice cream on your thigh. So what? You have drippy, fabulous, melted ice cream. Who the hell cares that you have it on your thigh? It doesn't help anything. It's never going to come from out there. It might have helped when you were 2 or 1. But, you know, my mother has said to me over and over, even just last week, she said, "Will you ever forgive me?" And we've been through this before. A couple years ago, she asked me to forgive her. But it wasn't at that point anymore about forgiving her. It was about understanding that what I believed about myself, what I interpreted about myself based on her actions, was not true. That's the only thing. That is the true forgiveness. If forgiveness means lightness, if forgiveness means the wound is disappearing, that's, and I don't know if it does or if it doesn't, and as I just said to Arazu, it's such a loaded word that it gets confusing in there. So let's just call awareness of what's true. Yes, Jessica.
Hi, Judy. Do you want to hear just the conclusion part or the whole thing?
The conclusion.
The conclusion is that I'm not good enough and I have to always be hyper-vigilant about being better and improving. And the unavoidable conclusion that's always wrong. And I was really able to feel deep healing about it.
Yes, good.
Thank you.
Right. That's where we start really unwinding the process when we, because I've said this a couple of times since we started, the pain of believing that we're unworthy, that we're not lovable, that we're not good enough, that we're wrong, is unbearable. I mean, I can say it, I can reel it off, the pain of believing we're unworthy, we're not lovable, we're not, but actually allowing yourself to feel what you never allowed yourself to feel before with the light of awareness that is infused with love as well. It's not just a, okay, I'm aware that I felt unworthy. It's a sense of softness, of love, of being on your own side, of being willing to hold yourself here and say, sweetheart, sweetheart, I'm so sorry you believed that. That's where the forgiveness comes. I'm so sorry that for all these years you believed something that wasn't true and that you have projected that out onto the entire world. That is what you believe about yourself. Somebody else? Any questions about the process itself? Any questions I want to hear about the process itself? Anybody have any questions? Come on, girls. You got to have some questions. Joyce, yeah.
I am imagining for myself that last stage, is it number 6?
Yes.
Is imagining my inner child, the one that had that experience, that I'm somehow parenting that child and talking to it as if, you know, that's not you and, you know, you aren't this way. And is that...
That's fine. I mean, the truth is there are no inner children. There just aren't. That's the language we use. That's the solidifying of impressions and experiences that we use. And I myself am guilty of that, as is Loren, who I have worked with on this many times. You know, in this messy, magnificent life, there was a chapter, Be Kind to the Ghost Children. As if those children are real. There are no inner children. There are just memories, associations, impressions. Now, I do still see myself when I do this process over and over. I do see myself standing in the kitchen listening to my mother and Laura talk about the Eskimo coat. I'm right back there. I see that kid. And so for as long as it takes, I will say to that kid, I'm so sorry. But I do want to say it becomes more and more amorphous because it's not really you, the adult you, saying to that impression of the kid, it's you as love, it's you as presence, it's you as all that is, it's you as awareness, speaking to that contraction, that wound, that unbearable pain that we say is living in that structure of a child. And so if it is helpful, then we do it. We do it until those things begin dissolving. And we understand that it was our interpretation, and we understand the limits of language, and we understand the limits of memory, and we understand that it's love shining on a wound and shining on a contraction and shining on true, unbearable pain. And for many of us, and I told you this yesterday about my own process in the last couple of weeks, really, I became so aware that, and this was in the guise of having to choose certain things, that, you know, people to work with for my team for the new book, and thinking, God, if I make a mistake, I'll ruin everything. The whole thing depends on me. I'm in control. And then that brought me back to being a kid and feeling like I was in control and that I could make my mother happy and I could make my father happy. But I kept going with that and understood, as I said yesterday, the heartbreak. There was such heartbreak and just being alive for quite a long time that I wouldn't let myself feel. Because I had to lift myself up and, you know, I had to make it through this crazy family. I had to get out of there alive. I mean, I suppose some kids don't. But that heartbreak, and you'd think after 40 years of therapy and 40 years of breath work and Reiki and therapy and hitting pillows and gestalt work and somatic experience and internal family systems and, I mean, you name it, I've done it, that would have come out. But there it was last week as if I had never experienced it before. And it felt almost crushing. And then I realized I could feel that because it was good that it was coming up, because if it doesn't come up, there's no chance of it dissipating. And so it's a willingness to experience what I've never been willing to experience, and the same is true for you. And I will say that it takes courage. It takes steadfastness. It takes willingness to act. It's not going to happen. It's not going to fall on you like snow. You're not going to come to a workshop or a retreat like this and suddenly get it. This was installed before you could talk. Understanding with your mind will not dissolve it. You are the only one who can dissolve what you, as the only one, interpreted as a lie. That's how it goes. Can you, in retreats like this and with ongoing support, and we offer so much support. So much support. And that support is basically saying, here, sweetheart, here's the key. Would you like to use it now? Here's the key that we found to unlock the wounds that you're seeing through. That's not the best metaphor, but in any case, here's the key. Would you like it? Do you want to use it? Or would you rather go back to wishing somebody else will do it for you? For the longest time, I felt like I didn't deserve what I got. I didn't deserve this mother. I didn't deserve this, Father. I didn't deserve this grisly childhood. It wasn't the childhood that Charles Manson had. My mother did not trade me for a can of beer. That's great. But it was awful and cruel and physically and sexually abusive. I wanted somebody to make it better. Many people said to me, you didn't deserve it. It didn't matter. I had already installed those conclusions. It didn't matter. Matt, I mean, is it wonderful to be with somebody who loves me and who I love? Yes. Did it undo those wounds? No. No, because it can't. Nothing on the outside will ever do it. That is the good news, and that is the bad news. That is the bad news. But it's the great news, because you have the agency. You have the authority. You have the power. You have the power. It's not up to anybody else. They're not to blame, and you're no longer a victim. Was I a victim of an abusive childhood? Yes. If I still feel myself as a victim of any situation that I'm in, I mean any situation I'm in, then I'm a child. Okay, everybody. Let's go around the room with one word. Then we'll check into our hunger. We will continue this afternoon. You'll continue this in your community meetings. We're not, you know, finished with this, but this is a wonderful. Now, I know many of you who have been to a retreat with me in the last number of years are familiar with this process. It's what we do. It's what I do. We didn't do it yesterday, obviously. I mean, there are other things we do. But this is the heart of it, because without that conclusion, there's no problem. There's no pain. You might have physical pain, but nothing's wrong, because it doesn't hit on the sore spots, on I'm not lovable, I've been abandoned, I'm rejected, I'm not good enough. It doesn't hit in those places, because there are no longer those places to be hit upon. There is not a me person there anymore. What a relief. What a relief. Let's go around with one word. Julie, can you start? No. No mic. It's too much. Say it loud. Thinking. Try coming out of that mind, Jane. The mind is not going to help you, darling. It's not going to happen in the mind. How about dropping the mind into the heart? Into the heart. Kathy? All right. Rachel? Kim? Love. Cheryl? A lot of people are reflective. That's good. Yeah? Enlightening. Relieved. Healing. Light. Progress. That's not a feeling. That's a description of an action. What's a feeling? Healing. Thank you. Okay, everybody. So we're about to go into lunch, the lunchroom. Check in, because we are about to go to lunch, check into your hunger level. How's the hunger level? 1 to 10. 1 is really, really hungry. Five is comfortable. Ten is stuffed. Whoops. Were you on the hunger scale? Put your fingers up. Let me see. Okay, we got quite a few hungers and some not so hungers. Okay, and then the emotional hunger scale. One is feeling needy, empty, really dragging around the gloomy doomies, as I call them. Five is feeling fine. 10 is feeling really good. Let's see. All right. It must be that Maui calling. Maui calling. I know I feel very excited about doing this in Maui. But that's in the future, so stay here, Janine. You're in San Rafael right now. You're not in Maui. Okay. All right. Okay, so do you have a sense of what you'd like to eat? Do you want, so just take another 30 seconds and then we're going. Another 30 seconds. Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it protein? Is it fat? What is it? Close your eyes. Now, obviously, you don't have, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of the variety of foods here. But there are categories of protein and fat and carbs and light or heavy like that. So do you have a sense of what it is? Okay, I'll see you in the dining room.